verse 10. So he was giving thus six additional practices, three more to abandon, three more to practice. So the three to abandon were taking intoxicants, yeah, and that, not to abandon, but things we should do is abandon taking intoxicants, maintain a proper livelihood, and abandon harming others. And then there's three more, being respectfully generous, honoring the worthy, and cultivating love. Okay? So being respectfully generous, you know, being generous with what we have, you know, and not just thinking, this is mine, and if I give it to somebody, then I won't have it. Yeah. But really thinking, if I don't give, then what merit will I have? You know, reverse the way of thinking. And it's kind of amazing how miserliness comes up in our mind, and how we, I think, oh, if I only had such and such amount, then I could be more generous. Then I would feel financially secure and I could give more. Do you know anybody who feels financially secure? Do you know anybody who has enough money? They could all use some more. I mean, even these 30-somethings that make it big in Silicon Valley or wherever, they still keep needing more money. Nobody ever feels like they have enough. Yeah? So don't say to yourself, I'll be generous once I have more. But realize that generosity is a state of mind. It's not how much you have and how much you give. It's your state of mind when giving. Okay, so again, this is very different than what society says, because society says it's the amount you give. Buddhism says it's your motivation when you give. Yeah, because somebody could give a whole lot because they want their name on the side of the Philharmonic building or, you know, the temple or whatever it is. Yeah, and somebody else may give a little bit because they don't have so much, but their intention is really that other people benefit. Yeah? So it's the intention that makes an act generous. Yeah, and I feel quite strongly about that. Like, I wouldn't want somebody to give to the Abbey because they felt obliged to, you know, like, well, yeah, I should give more, I should give something, you know, with that kind of, you know, then there's no joy in giving. But when people really give because they appreciate what other people are doing, or because they want to give, they feel good about giving, then, you know, it's real generosity, and it's really rather beautiful. Yeah. And also, when we give, where we don't calculate in our mind how much we've given to that person and how much they've given back to us. Yeah. I don't know about you, but in my family, when I was a little kid, I remember it was like, what did that person give us last year at the holidays? So we can give them something of corresponding value, but we don't want to spend more on them than they spent on us last year. You know, that takes the joy out of giving. So to really, you know, just relax about it and follow what's in our heart, but be practical, you know, because if you gave everything away and then you didn't have anything, you become a pain in the neck to other people, so, you know. Yeah. Okay, and here it says respectfully generous. So when we're generous, it's not just like here. It's, you know, we have a respectful mind, our body gives respectfully. Yeah. I spoke to one of the students when I was teaching in Seattle, we were talking a lot about generosity, and he told me he went to Berkeley, and there was one woman sitting on the street panhandling, and he didn't have very much, so he took out a dollar or whatever and kind of kneeled down, and with both hands, because that's, you know, kind of a really nice way to give an offering is with both hands, and said, you know, "I'm sorry I don't have more, but I want to give this to you," and did it in a really respectful way. And this woman looked up at him, and I forget what he said, she said it, but it was something to the effect, what she acknowledged was that he had given respectfully to her. It wasn't just, "Oh, you're a person on the street, yeah, here, and you keep walking." Yeah. And that respect that he gave her when he gave the dollar meant more to her than the dollar did. Yeah. People really value, yeah, how they're treated by others. That's an important thing. So to give respectfully. And that means also in our mind. So it's not, you know, "Oh, you slob, you can't keep your life together. Here's a granola bar." You know, it's not like that. It's really respecting the person as another human being. Okay, the next one was honoring the worthy. So this is people who are worthy of respect, people who have good qualities, and we want to emulate their good qualities. And so we honor them. I mean, this is why we bow to the Buddha. Not because the Buddha needs us to bow, but because we think about the Buddha's quality and with a mind of respect, I mean, see his great qualities. He's certainly worthy of respect. And then we bow and we make offerings, and doing that helps our mind. Yeah. The Buddha doesn't need flowers and, oh, what did he get today? No fruit? Oh, poor Buddha, he didn't get an apple and an orange, my goodness. Just lots of flowers and some water. Huh. So, you know, the Buddha doesn't need this stuff. Yeah. If you're a Buddha, you know, other people respecting you and giving you bananas and oranges, you know, that's not the delight of your day, okay? But rather, we make offering because it helps us to see the good qualities of the Buddha, and by seeing them, then we want to emulate them. So that helps us to be more receptive to the Buddha's teachings and to really try and generate the same good qualities that the Buddha has, you know? And just to learn to be patient when we don't get apples and oranges, you know? Okay, so respecting the Buddhas, bodhisattvas, other living beings who we think have made great contributions and whose qualities we respect, to show, you know, to honor the worthy. And then the last one is cultivating love. Yeah, so this is one that is so wonderful to do, because if we can really cultivate a loving attitude and have that be our basis for operating in the world. I mean, just think what that would be. Wherever you went, whatever living being you saw, your spontaneous feeling would be, you know, seeing them in beauty, seeing them as having an affectionate attitude towards them, and wanting them to be happy. Wouldn't that be nice? that's when you're on automatic, that's what you're on automatic with. Okay. Early November, I'm going to be doing the last segment of the teachings from Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions. It's one of your books back there. And it's teaching about the different Buddhist traditions. And so we're on the last section of the book, or the last chunk. You know, it's more than one section. But especially talking about love and compassion and bodhicitta and the paramitas. And it's really beautiful to go through in the Pali tradition. There's many different ways of explaining the four immeasurables, which we also practice in the Mahayana tradition. But one way they have that I think is so nice and really practical is our default method of working with sentient beings is love. Yeah? So that we train our mind that whenever we see any sentient being, our natural way of relating to them is with friendliness, with a wish for them to be well, with a wish for their good well-being. Now, wouldn't that be nice if your mind was well trained in that, and you're on the New York subway, and everybody's pushing and pulling, and you just look around and you want everybody to be happy? Yeah? Wouldn't that be nice? Or you go into work and you just look at all your colleagues and you want them all to be well? Or you go in and you see your family and that child, the one child that's especially difficult to raise, you know? You have just same attitude towards that kid, a loving attitude. Yeah, it'd be really nice, wouldn't it? Yeah. You go into the grocery store, you're at the gas station, you're in the bank. Yeah. Even you turn on the news, everybody you look at with a loving attitude. That'd be really nice. So to train your mind, you know, because love is, you know, one order of putting the four immeasurables in. Love is the first one. So that's the way you greet everybody, just normally. That's normal. Then, when you see different sentient beings suffering and facing difficulties, then you switch from love to compassion, because compassion is wanting them to be free of suffering and its causes. So there you focus more on compassion. Yeah? So you see people suffering, you see people in a bad mood. You see the people on the subway, on the street, you know, there's people who are acting kind of odd all around. Yeah, New York's full of them, including us. But we think we're normal. You know, this hotel I was staying at in New York, it was right by the Javits Center, and that's where Comic-Con was on. So I was wondering if they thought I was part of Comic-Con. Yeah? I didn't know what Comic-Con was. I just saw, like, Superman and Goldilocks and, like, boy, this is interesting around this part of town. And then somebody told me what it was, okay? But, yeah, so I fit in perfectly. Nobody stared. Yeah, but, you know, when you see people, you know, there was also the guy who was screaming on the subway and pushing and such like that. So you see those people, but you wish them to be well instead of, you know, just hating them or, you know, recoiling against them. Okay? So normal practice, love, friendliness. When they're suffering, compassion. Yeah? When they've done something fantastic, or when they've had a really good opportunity, instead of being envious or jealous, rejoicing. That's the third one. Okay? So even somebody you don't like, even your competitor, has a really good opportunity or has something good befall them, you rejoice and you say, how wonderful. That one's harder, isn't it? Yeah. Rejoicing is the last thing we want to do when we're jealous of somebody. Because when we're jealous, we want to destroy their happiness and take it for ourselves. Rejoice, out of the question. That's why it's the antidote to jealousy, because it's the opposite, okay? But, you know, can imagine if you can really be happy when other people, even people you don't like, you know, have a good opportunity. Instead of always thinking, me, 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 yeah, they have a good opportunity. To get myself to practice rejoicing, sometimes it was like pulling teeth, really, and not baby teeth that are wiggling, you know. There, when I lived in Italy, I had a great, I have so many Italy stories, I will not bore you with them. But one of them is, there was one young monk who was very arrogant, you know, like most of the macho Italian men. Excuse, I'm making a generalization. Not all of them are like that. I'm not criticizing all the macho Italian men or even the Italian men. But there is a habit. So, and he was younger than me in ordination and in ages. But because he was a monk and I was a nun, he got opportunities that I didn't have. Because you see, there's absolutely no gender discrimination in Buddhism. So, oh, sometimes I was so jealous, you know. And I had somebody had given me a postcard of one of my teachers, Senchab Sirkin Rinpoche, riding a yak in Spiti. And it was this beautiful postcard, just indicative of, just, I can even have it in my mind now, just Rinpoche's whole body posture was just, you know, how he was as a person. And I love that photograph. And then I thought, I should give it to this guy. I thought, no, you don't want to give it to him. And then I realized, well, yeah, I'm jealous. Yeah, if I'm going to overcome my jealousy and learn to wish him well, I have to be able to give something that I like, that I think he will like also, because he was also a disciple of Sirkin Rinpoche. So I gave him the picture. No? And every once in a while, my mind would go, what would it be like to still have that picture? But then I realized just now in telling you the story, I still have that picture. It's very firmly in my mind. I don't need the picture. Yeah. It was good to, he had an opportunity I didn't have, rejoice. Okay, now if you think that means that I didn't say anything about women's position in Buddhism, you're wrong. You know, I also said things. Okay, but I learned I had to deal with my jealousy. Okay, so love is the default, compassion when sentient beings are suffering, when they're doing well, rejoicing. Yeah, and when either nothing much is going on or they're having difficulties but they're not open to help, then equanimity, the fourth immeasurable. Yeah. So this one also can be difficult sometimes. All four immeasurables, they're challenging. Yeah. But this one, to just remain equal, when you can see somebody going down a slippery slope, you reach out and try and help, and they resist. They don't want any of it. Okay? You ever had that happen? Yeah? Maybe with a son or a daughter or a brother or a sister or a parent or a good friend or a student or who knows who. You know, you can see somebody's kind of hanging on around the edge of the cliff and you try and help them and give them some good advice. They don't want to hear it. Okay? That's the time when we often get angry and we feel frustrated. You know? And we say, I'm trying to do so much, and this person is so stubborn and so obstinate, and they just won't cooperate. Which is gobbledygook for I can't control them. Yeah, because why are we frustrated? Because we can't control them. And because we can see that they're setting themselves up for a lot of pain and we can't do anything about it. And we care about them. And that's really hard. That's really hard when you care about somebody and you see them going down the wrong path. But the only thing to do in that kind of situation is to remain equanimous. You know, keep the door open, keep your own mind equal, don't get frustrated and angry, don't lash out at them, don't feel sorry for yourself. Yeah, keep the door open and then turn your attention to being able to benefit the people who are more receptive. Yeah, because there's some people that aren't so receptive. My mother had an expression. Did it come up earlier this week? One of her expressions, don't knock your head against the wall. Yeah, good expression. Not that people go around knocking their head against the wall, but what she meant was, you know, when things aren't gonna budge and you can't change the situation, don't inflict pain on yourself. Yeah, because the wall is going to win. The wall is not going to bend to your head. Yeah, and so this is where equanimity is really important. Yeah, there's somebody you try and benefit, they turn around and criticize you, they dump on you, they tell you to mind your own business. Who knows? We've all been through it, haven't we? Yeah. And to at that time be able to maintain an equal mind. Yeah. We don't go into rejection and abandonment and frustration. Equal mind and leave the door open. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's hard. When my parents were aging, well, when they're aging, we're all aging. yeah, when they were getting especially aged, the three of us siblings wanted them to move into an assisted living place. They refused. We do not want to go into an assisted living place. We like our home. We're staying at our home. But their home had hard floors without carpeting, and both my mother and father fell a lot. And it's dangerous when the floor is hard, you know. One time, both of them were down on the ground at the same time. Neither of them could get up. They had to crawl over to the phone and call 911 so somebody would come and pick them up off the ground. We didn't want that to happen to them. We wanted them to be safe. They didn't want any of it. Yeah? So, you know, the way I handled it was, you know, it's their life. This is their choice. I don't think it's such a good choice. But for them, you know, what they want and what they don't want. They're the ones who know that, and so I have to respect it. And I laid off, and they stayed in their home. And as it turned out, neither of them died from falling on the ground. Okay, thank goodness. They died from other things. But, you know, you just have to... That's it. You can't control. Yeah, and it's hard because, you know, we just thought, how many times can they both wind up on the ground together? Yeah, before even the 911 people get tired of coming. Okay, so generating love, that was the 16th one. But it actually includes all four of the four measurables. Verse 11, Dharma does not come about merely through engaging in physical austerities. Through that type of practice, one neither ceases harming others, nor does one benefit them. So especially at the time of the Buddha, there was a lot of people doing very extreme austerity practices, standing on one leg, sitting in fires. People do that nowadays. What's the guy's name? Tom? Somebody? Robbins? Teaches you how to walk across fire?
Tony Robbins?
Yeah. Walk across fire. So, you know, they had these kinds of things. You know, all, just torturing the body. And this exists in Western culture, too, in the Catholic Church. It was very strong, using, you know, whipping, self-flagellation, and horsehair shirts, and all this kind of stuff, okay? So Nagarjuna is saying that when you do that, you're neither stopping harming others, nor are you benefiting them. So what's the use of your austerity practices? Yeah, it doesn't cut your own attachment to your body. Yeah, you're still just as attached to your body if you make your body suffer. So one meaning of the middle way is, on one hand, no austerity practices. On the other hand, no self-indulgence. We tend to go to the extreme of self-indulgence, don't we? Okay? We want to go out for ice cream, and then we go to Saks Fifth Avenue, and then we go buy a red sports car, and, you know, okay, we go that extreme. And then the other one is, when I lived at Koh Phan, there was one monk who, he was doing this, but because the place where we lived, the floor was brick, so it was really cold. And he just put one mat on top of it, a grass mat, and he slept there. And Lama Yeshe would come sometimes and check our rooms and see what was going on. And he walked into this monk's room, and there it was, just that mat. And he said, "Are you Milarepa? You're sleeping on one grass mat? Go get yourself a mattress." Yeah, Lama would have none of this kind of, you know, "Look at me, I'm so ascetic, aren't I great?" trip. Okay, verse 12. One who does not respect the great path of the true Dharma, with its manifest generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude, follows the mistaken path of inflicting hardship on the body, just as a cow in a herd follows the line of cattle. Okay. Such a person with a body entwined by the savage snakes of negative mental states wanders for a very long time in the terrifying wilderness of cyclic existence, whose trees are limitless beings. So this is talking about people who go on the wrong path. So one of these people who don't respect the great path of the true Dharma with its manifest generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude. So, who doesn't respect generosity? Who doesn't think it's a good thing to have? Who doesn't respect ethical conduct? Who doesn't respect having internal strength, or what we might call patience with, you know, difficult people? Everybody respects those qualities. Yeah? So these are the qualities the Buddha Dharma teaches. So Nagarjuna is saying somebody who doesn't respect those qualities, yeah, who thinks the opposite of generosity is good and the opposite of ethical conduct is good and the opposite of fortitude is good, they're going to be going down a pretty bad path and wind up in a not very good place mentally and in terms of their rebirth. Okay? Somebody who follows the mistaken path of inflicting hardship on the body. You know, some one of these ascetics, you still have them in India, especially in Marrakesh. You know, people who spend years standing on one foot, who never bathe, who grow their hair out, you know, all sorts of stuff. So, like I said, torturing the body does not eliminate our attachment to it. So making that your chief practice, also going down the wrong path. So he's comparing people who follow the wrong path or who follow bad teachers to a cow in a herd that is leading a line of cattle. Okay? So Nagarjuna is comparing this cow, the head cow, to not only one person who follows the bad path, a wrong path, but somebody who teaches the wrong path to other people. So it's like when you have a herd of cows, I know New Yorkers don't know what cows look like, but you know, you know what the drawing on milk cans look like, so, you know, okay, they kind of look like that, but bigger. Yeah, and yeah, you come out where I live and you'll see cows. You know, one cow, you know, all the other cows just follow that one lead cow. Yeah, it's really like follow the leader. And so if that lead cow takes a path that is on the edge of a cliff, yeah, and all the other cows follow, they're all in danger. If that cow takes a path going down into the forest, yeah, where they have lions and tigers and bears, ho-ho, that cow is going to be, and all the other cows that follow are going to be in great danger. Yeah? So that's like somebody who has wrong ideas about what the Dharma is, what the path to liberation is, and teaches those ideas to other people, and then other people, just because that's the head honcho, they follow that person without having discriminating wisdom. So then everybody winds up in the middle of the jungle. Everybody winds up following wrong paths. So do you remember the days with Jim Jones? Remember that guy and his community? He moved them, I think, to Central America somewhere, and then he had them all take cyanide, and himself included. Yeah? That's an extreme example, but it's a very effective one of somebody who follows the wrong path and then drew others into following the wrong path. Okay? Nowadays, one thing that I think we need to be very careful of is this, how to say, when Buddhism comes to the West, there's all different sorts of teachers teaching all different sorts of things. And you really need to be aware and you need to be astute and follow teachers who are teaching according to what the Buddha taught. Yeah. Unfortunately, there are some people who make up their own thing. They may think that they're teaching what the Buddha taught, but they aren't. I don't know how many of these people think, well, I'll make up my own thing and I'll pass it off as Buddhism. I don't know if they have a crass motivation like that, or if they just don't understand what the Buddha said. Or some of the things that the Buddha said, they don't like. It doesn't jive with them. So you have people nowadays saying, oh, the Buddha didn't teach rebirth. Yeah. The Buddha taught rebirth. It's right there in the scriptures. But some people say, Buddha didn't teach rebirth. Okay. So that's different than, like, when we come to the Dharma, we may not fully understand rebirth. It may not make total sense to us. We think about it, put it on the back burner, don't stress about it, keep practicing what makes sense to you, come back to rebirth later, you know, think about the argument some more, see if it makes more sense to you later. That's one thing, you know, and that's fine. You're just investigating and taking your time. The other thing is people saying, I don't like the thinking, you know, the idea of rebirth makes me really uncomfortable. I don't think the Buddha really taught it. Yeah? And then teaching that kind of view to others. That's very dangerous. So there's this whole thing called secular Buddhism nowadays, which I don't think is fair to even call Buddhism. If you don't agree with all the Buddha's ideas and you want something different, call it secular and put your name at the end of it. You know? If you think the Buddha didn't know what he was talking about and that you know better, then just create your own religion. Don't call it Buddhism. Put it your name on it. Okay? So I think this whole thing of secular Buddhism, you know, we're going to strip away everything that we think, you know, that is cultural. But do we all the time understand what is culture and what is Dharma? Yeah? Saying, oh, rebirth, the idea of rebirth, that's just cultural. We don't need that. Actually, you know, if there's no rebirth, then you have to totally rewrite everything because nothing, the whole path doesn't make sense. Yeah. If there's no rebirth, then if you want to end suffering, the best thing to do is die because there's no rebirth. So if you're suffering, kill yourself. This is what people who suicide think. Yeah. But the point is, killing yourself doesn't stop your suffering. You get reborn. Yeah. I had one inmate that I write to tell me that, you know, because he was, he's a trans person, and so very difficult, and also incredible, as growing up as a child, so much abuse. And he told me at one point, you know, he was thinking of suicide, but he had started learning Buddhism, and when he thought, but there's rebirth, then he thought, I'm not going to kill myself. It's not going to do any good. You know, it made him stop the idea of suicide because he realized totally fruitless to do that. Yeah? But if somebody's saying, oh, there's absolutely no rebirth, when you die, you're dead, you feel nothing. Yeah, that's then, you know, people could look at that and say, oh, well, then the way to end suffering is we should all kill ourselves or kill each other, and that way we end suffering. Yeah. Totally wrong logic. Totally harmful. Yeah. So this is why Nagarjuna is really cautioning against following wrong teachers or about generating wrong beliefs ourselves. Mm-hmm. But like I said, holding on to a wrong belief is very different than questioning things and you haven't come to a full understanding, so you're still investigating. Those are two different ball games there. Okay. So now Nagarjuna is going to go into talking about some of the effects of negative karma, okay? And so again, this is done to help us understand the effects of our actions so that we can make wise decisions. So these are not threats, they are not punishments. It's just, he's saying, when you plant daisies, you get daisies. When you plant chili peppers, you get chili peppers. So check the seed packet that you're planting. You know, check what's written on it. Plant what you want. So in the same way with our actions, if you don't want suffering, stop negative actions. And if you want happiness, do virtuous actions. So there's many results of karma. Some are in terms of the kind of body we take rebirth in, the realm we're born into. Some are results that are similar to what we've done in terms of how the experience we made somebody else have, we have that same experience. Some of them are similar to what we've done in the sense that we have the habitual tendency to act that way again. That's one of the worst results. Yeah. And then another result is the environmental result that talks about the kind of environment we live in. Yeah. And the kind of climate we have and how the climate changes. Okay, so due to killing, one is born with a short lifespan. Makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, if you kill, you wind up dying young. You know, maybe not in the life you kill, but in a future life. Due to violence, one encounters much torment. Also makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, again, maybe not in this life, maybe in the next life, but if we're violent, then violence comes back to us. Due to stealing, one becomes impoverished because we made others lose their belongings. Due to adultery, one has enemies. That one doesn't even need to wait until next life. That happens right away. Okay. By lying, one becomes reviled. People don't believe us. People don't trust us. And why should they? If we've lied, why in the world should people trust us? Yeah, it's a good question, you know, to ask ourselves when we're having some interpersonal conflict with somebody, and we say to that person, you don't trust me. And to say, have I been completely trustworthy? Yeah, why should that person trust me? Am I honest? Am I trustworthy? Okay, in this life, also previous lives. Through speaking divisively, one loses friends. That also happens in this life. Due to speaking harshly, one hears unpleasant sounds, like criticism. Yeah, that also happens this life and future lives. From engaging in idle talk, one's words will be disregarded. Again, this life and future life, somebody who blah-blahs all the time, you tune them out. Covetousness destroys one's desired objects. Yeah, when you're coveting something that belongs to somebody else, you know, it destroys that object in some way, you know, because you're making it yours when it isn't yours. Yeah. And covetousness, I think, would also result in poverty. Yeah. Or having other people desire your stuff. Yeah. Break in your house, try and steal it, whatever. Malice is said to bestow fear. This one, I think, is quite psychologically, you can see it. When we hold a lot of malice against other people, yeah, our mind is really negative, very harmful towards them. Then we begin to think that everybody has that kind of malice and harmful intent. And so we begin to feel afraid because we're projecting the malice in our heart onto other people, thinking they have malice towards us, and then we get afraid. Yeah? And you can see this sometimes with people. Yeah? When people have a lot of anger and hatred, they become very suspicious of other people. Yeah? Because they're projecting the way their mind thinks onto other people and thinking those people think the same about them. Mm-hmm. Wrong view leads to evil world views. Yeah, in other words, wrong views lead to more wrong views. Consuming intoxicants brings mental confusion. Duh! It's true, isn't it? It brings lots of mental confusion. Through not giving gifts, one is poor. So again, stinginess breeds poverty. Yeah. Wrong livelihood results in getting tricked. Yeah, when we've acted with improper livelihood, been deceptive towards others, then other people will trick us and take advantage of us. Yeah. Have you ever thought, when you think people are taking advantage of you, that this may be due to actions you've previously done? We don't think that, do we? But it does. There's a very clear link. Yeah. People try and trick us? Oh, I had lots of wrong livelihood in previous lives. This is just coming around to me. Arrogance leads to a lowly station. So when you're very arrogant, when we're arrogant and puffed up and we think we're superior to others, yeah, what comes back is we're born in a very low status in society. So it's very interesting when you think about this, yeah, that, you know, the people who are rich who exploit others, next rebirth, maybe become the people who are exploited by their employers. Yeah, people who mistreat others because they have a lot of power in the next life become somebody who is oppressed. They're part of an oppressed population. Okay. So you know how when you were really little, at least when I was little, my mother and father would always say, think of how it would feel to be the other person. Like when I got mad at a friend or something, think of how it would feel to be that person. Would your feelings get hurt if somebody acted that way towards you. So that's kind of the way we think about these things. If I act in a certain way, this is what I'm going to experience. I don't like that experience, but that's the experience I'm forcing on other people through my disturbing actions. So if I don't want to be treated that way, you know, I should back off on treating other people that way. So when you think about this, you know, deeply, and then you look at what Donnie is doing and what Jeffy is doing. Excuse me, I have to call them by affectionate terms. Donnie and Jeffy, you know? And you think of the karma that they are creating. It's horrific, you know? Jeff is taking away civil rights. And, you know, the karmic result of that is, you know, being born as in an oppressed population without civil rights yourself. Yeah. Donnie is threatening people, you know. The result, he's going to receive a lot of threats back. It's happening already before his next life, you know. He and Kim are just, like I said earlier this week, I think we should put the two of them in a sandbox and let them slug it out and leave the rest of us live in peace instead of just throwing threats back and forth at each other. Yeah. So again, I don't think that's political. I think that's ethical. Yeah? If you are the leader of a country, do you have the right to endanger your population by throwing threats at somebody with a nuclear bomb? Do you have that right? Is that something for you to do? Is that being a responsible human being? Okay. Arrogance leads to a lowly station. Jealousy brings about unattractive appearance. Think about it. When people are jealous, do they look attractive? When you're jealous, do you have a beautiful expression on your face that draws other people to you because you're so attractive? No. Sorry. But it's true, isn't it? Okay, so jealousy brings about an attractive appearance. From anger comes a bad complexion. That doesn't mean having lots of pimples. It doesn't mean returning to adolescence, you know? But a bad complexion, a bad look on your face, body language that speaks of resentment and aggression. Yeah. Are angry people attractive? It's similar with jealous people. Yeah, angry people, your face is red, your pulse is, you know, this, and you know, you look at somebody's angry face and you want to go away. Yeah? Stupidity comes from not questioning the wise. Okay? In other words, when there are people there to learn from, and we don't ask questions because we think, oh, my question, people will think I'm stupid if I ask that question. You know how you hold back? Yeah, I don't want to ask a question from all these people. My question will be stupid. Everybody will think I'm stupid. And so you lose your opportunity to learn something because you don't ask a question. So from stupidity comes from not questioning the wise. These are the effects when one is born as human, but prior to all of them is a bad rebirth, is an unfortunate rebirth. Okay? So before you even get around to these results, there's an unfortunate rebirth to contend with. So if you want to learn more about karma, I find it very, very helpful, you know, to study some of the texts about karma, because it really gives me a very practical way to look at my own behavior and my own thoughts. And so the book Good Karma, I don't know, do you have that one back there? No, you don't. Okay, but Good Karma is about Dhammarakshita's poem, The Wheel of Sharp Weapons. And in this poem, he talks about, and he's like, he also doesn't pull any punches. He says, you know, when you're experiencing this, this is the wheel of sharp weapons returning, you know, on you for the things that you've done. And then he details the kind of actions that we've done that have brought about that kind of result in our lives. Yeah. So the idea is that our actions are like throwing a boomerang. We're putting energy out, the boomerang comes back to us. So what we make other people experience comes around back to us. Yeah? And so it's good to really think, you know, what am I causing others to experience? How am I treating other living beings? Yeah? Am I creating virtuous causes? Am I being kind to others? Okay? So really taking time to think about this. So this is all very, very practical stuff that we can employ in our lives right away. Yeah? Doesn't need complicated philosophy or even simple philosophy. But if we practice it, we'll have good relationships with other people now. When we die, we won't have regrets. And when we're reborn, we'll have a good situation and be able to continue to practice. Okay. So verse 19, we are whizzing along here. Such are widely known to be the ripening results of these actions that are called non-virtues. For all the virtuous actions, there are the opposite effects. So it's good not to just think about the non-virtuous actions and the results they bring, but think about acting in the opposite way. And there's actually two opposite ways. One is every time you abandon a negative action, that itself is virtue, just abandoning it. The second thing that's virtuous is if you do the opposite. So instead of killing, you actively protect life. Instead of stealing, you're actively generous. Okay? Instead of lying, you are actively truthful. Okay? So this is different than just not killing or not stealing or not lying. Okay? So either abandoning the negative one or doing the opposite. Both of those are virtuous actions. And then they bring the opposite results to what he just laid out here. So that's very good to go through yourself. I think at 4 o'clock there's study time and yoga. So very good. Go through the 16 and think about, well, the 16 were what the virtuous ones are. Think about what the results of those are going to be. Then think about their opposites, the non-virtue. Think about what the results of those are going to be. Yeah? And if you do that, then, you know, reading the newspaper becomes an incredible long-run teaching. Incredible, you know, because you see people creating causes, and it makes you think about what the effects are going to be. You see people experiencing effects, and it makes you think of what the causes they created must have been. Yeah? Very, very helpful. Okay. Now, verse 20 is one of the famous verses. Throughout Precious Garland, many times when you're studying other commentaries, they will quote Precious Garland. And so the verse 20 is one of the verses that is often quoted. Attachment, anger, confusion, and the karma that arises from them are non-virtuous. Non-attachment, non-anger, non-confusion, and the karma that arises from them are virtuous. Okay? Now, we have to understand this properly. Yeah. Okay, so actions that we do with attachment are non-virtuous. Now, we have to know exactly what attachment means, because people often have the mistaken idea that being attracted to something or preferring something or desiring something, that that's all attachment. It's not. It depends on what you're preferring, what you're attached to, and what your mental state is. Okay. So, for example, if I prefer to go to a Dharma teaching rather than a football game, is that attachment? That's not attachment. Okay? So we can have virtuous preferences. It doesn't mean that we're attached. If I desire to realize emptiness, is that attachment? That's not attachment, okay? So the word desire is tricky, because in English, there can be two kinds of desire. One is attachment. I desire that hot fudge sundae, okay? That's attachment. I desire to realize emptiness is a virtuous aspiration. Don't confuse a virtuous aspiration with attachment. Okay? What's another example? I'm really a fan of Nagarjuna. I think Nagarjuna is fantastic. Is that attachment? No, it's not attachment. It's honest appreciation, for it's honoring the worthy, which we talked about in verse, one of the previous verses here. Yeah, I think Nagarjuna is fantastic. Doesn't mean I'm attached to him. That's something virtuous, you know, to admire Nagarjuna and his philosophy. Yeah. So I say this because very often when people think of, you know, here attachment, and attachment is non-virtuous, then they think that non-attachment, which is said to be virtuous here, they think non-attachment means you just sit there, you'd have no preferences, you have no ideas, you have nothing, you are a bump on a log. And that's the epitome of virtue. Yeah. Oh, I'm not attached to anything. You can bring all the handsome men by, I don't care. You can bring all the Buddhas by, I don't care either. I'm not attached to anything. Ridiculous. That's not non-attachment. Again, that's stupidity. Yeah. So we have to understand what non-attachment means. Because I look at my teachers, and my teachers have definite preferences for things. Yeah? They have definite preferences because they have the wisdom that can discern what thing is good to do at this moment and what thing is useful and what is not useful. So they will have preferences. Yeah, but the reason behind their preferences is not clinging attachment that exaggerates the good qualities of something. It's understanding that knows this is something that will be beneficial. Okay, are you getting the difference between these? Okay. Similarly, you know, when we say anger is non-virtuous and non-anger is virtuous, does that mean that whenever anybody does anything, you just sit there and, yeah, you just shot 58 people and wounded 500? No problem. I have no anger. What do you think? Is that virtuous? Again, ridiculous. Anger, getting angry and saying, you know, this guy's an idiot, how could he do that, that's anger. But saying, here's a suffering sentient being, and there's probably more people like him out there, and we need to act now to benefit these people and to prevent further tragedies. You know, you can be forceful. You can state something in a very, you know, forceful way, but that doesn't mean you're angry. Okay? So don't think that, you know, abandoning anger and having non-anger just means, again, you become a wimp. Yeah? Like the woman who's in a situation of domestic abuse. Oh, yeah, my husband beat me last week. He beat me this week. I have compassion for him, poor guy, suffering so much. So he beat me last week, no big deal. He beat me this week, no problem. He's going to beat me next week. I don't care. I have compassion for him. Is that compassion? You know, again, that's stupidity, isn't it? If somebody is harming you and creating destructive karma in the process, it is not compassion to let abuse continue on. It's not helpful to you, and it's not helpful to the other person. So that's not compassion. That's not non-anger. Okay? So I try and be clear about this because I find that we often get quite confused. You know, I think, oh, just whatever. Yeah, oh yeah. We have how many million guns in this country? More guns than there are people. No problem. I have compassion. All those people in the NRA and the munitions factories, they're just trying to earn a living and support their family. I have compassion for them. Okay. Then confusion. Yeah. Sometimes people translate this as attachment, anger, and ignorance. Okay. So there's two words in Tibetan. One is Timug and one is Marigpa. Both can be translated as ignorance depending on the situation. Because Marigpa is usually translated as ignorance. Timug can be translated as ignorance because sometimes it refers to self-grasping ignorance, the ignorance that misapprehends how we exist. But other times, Timug refers to misunderstanding the law of karma and its effects. So ignorance about cause and effect. So that kind of ignorance about karma is different than the ignorance that is the root of samsara that grasps inherent existence. Okay? So in that situation, it's better to translate timug as confusion in English to differentiate it from ignorance. Okay, so what are examples of confusion where we misunderstand how karma functions? Okay, one is animal sacrifice. Yeah, people think that if you sacrifice animals, you are appeasing the gods and creating the cause for happiness. Is that correct? Do they understand correctly the karmic result of killing animals? No. They think what they're doing is virtuous, but it's tremendously non-virtuous because many living beings are dying. Okay? So there's many actions like this that we may do in society that we think are virtuous, but are in fact non-virtuous. So the motivation doing them is this motivation of confusion, because we can't understand the difference between virtue and non-virtue. I'll give you another example, and I think most of you won't like this one, but it's true. Euthanizing animals. Yeah? We think that it's an act of kindness to euthanize an animal. It's saving it from suffering. We used to ask Lama Yeshe about this, and he said, if you have clairvoyant powers that can see somebody's future rebirth, and you know that by euthanizing this animal, it will have a better rebirth in the next life, then out of compassion, euthanize it, because you're putting it into a better state. But if you don't know where this animal is going to be reborn, and it could be reborn in a more painful state in the next life, then even though it's difficult for you to watch it suffer in this life, the compassionate thing to do is to let it die naturally. So at the Abbey, yeah, our initial three residents were me and two cats. So those two cats have subsequently died. We now have four new cats. But the way these cats died was extraordinary. The first one, because, you know, the idea of euthanizing never even entered my mind. That is not something that I even considered at all. Nor did any of the other Sangha members there consider that. So one of them, he had a kidney failure and was losing strength, and then he started having seizures. And this happened, the seizures started happening in the middle of a retreat. And at this time we didn't have Chenrezig Hall, so everything was happening in one building. It was one building was offices, dining room, kitchen, bedrooms, everything. So this cat, Achala, we put him in a bedroom so he could just be quiet and die peacefully. He came out into the dining room and lay there. He did not want to be alone in a bedroom. He parked himself right in the dining room, and we bought his little bed out there, and he laid in it. And so for, I think it must have taken 2, maybe 3 days, the death process, and everybody would come in, you know, for meals and say some mantra. He heard us all do our offering, food offering program, prayers, and we always do chanting, you know, before breakfast and after medicine meal. And he sat there picking up the good vibes of all these people doing retreat and having people come over and saying mantra and blowing on him. And then, you know, then it got really intense and he started having a lot of seizures, you know, and we were there, and we kind of gave him instructions and told him what to think and everything. He stopped breathing. We just left the body. We didn't touch it. All the people doing retreat kept coming in, you know, saying prayers, blowing mantras on Achala. Finally, we thought maybe his body was starting to decay, and that's usually the sign that the consciousness has left. So we moved his body to the barn. And then maybe 2 days after that, after the retreat had ended, the monastics, we took him up. We have a special place that's a pet cemetery, and we dug a hole. And when they lifted him up, there was no rigor mortis in his body, which is extraordinary because usually rigor mortis starts immediately. No rigor mortis. I didn't know about this until actually he was in the ground and covered. You know, otherwise I wouldn't have put him in. But, you know, we put him in the ground and then we did some more prayers and we covered him. But it's extraordinary that no rigor mortis. If he were a human being, we would have said, yogi. Yeah. The second cat, yeah, his name was Manjushri. Similar kind of thing, also kidney, but he wanted to be in a bedroom by himself. He didn't want to be together with everybody. But again, just he would have these seizures, and then he would have this amazing look on his face. And so similar thing with him. We left his body a full week without it decaying. Again, incredible. You know, again. You know, who was this cat? Because if a human being was like that, we would have definitely said they were, you know, in tukdan, meditation in the clear light. But anyway, you know, they both died naturally, and quite amazing. So I think that that we can let our pets die naturally. Why we usually euthanize them is we think we're putting them out of suffering, but very often what it is we can't stand to see them suffer. So we're stopping the suffering we experience from seeing them suffer. Because sometimes our pets are, you know, they're family members, aren't they? At least in my family, yeah. I talk to my parents, everybody talks about their pets. You know, we don't talk about cousins and aunts and uncles, we gossip about pets. But, you know, they're part of the family. So, yeah, so there's things like this when we talk about confusion, things that we may think are virtuous but are actually not. Yeah, and so those bring a lower rebirth. So the reason I stress this in this particular verse is because if you translate the first line, attachment, anger, and ignorance, and people think it's self-grasping ignorance, then when the next line says, and the karma that arises from them are non-virtuous, then people will think, well then, almost everything we do in samsara is non-virtuous because self-grasping ignorance is operating 99% of the time. But not everything we do under the influence of self-grasping ignorance is non-virtuous. You know, when we make offerings, when we study the Dharma, many things we do, there's still ignorance in our mind, but we don't have active wrong views, and our mind has a virtuous intention. Okay? So that, just because there's self-grasping ignorance, doesn't mean the karma created with it is non-virtuous. It's the ignorance that doesn't understand karma and its effects that's non-virtuous. Okay? Got it? Hope that will save you a lot of confusion, because I remember reading this verse translated the other way and going, what? How can that be? Okay. From non-virtue comes all suffering, likewise all unfortunate rebirths. From virtue comes all fortunate rebirths and the happiness within all rebirths. That's clear. Okay? I don't think I need to explain that one. Thus, dharma of higher rebirth is considered to be twofold. One should not engage in non-virtue through body, speech, and mind, but one should always engage in virtue through these three. So these verses, these are summarizing here what he's previously taught. So he's saying, you know, to create the causes for upper rebirth, abandon all non-virtue, practice all virtue. Because non-virtue is the source of suffering, virtue is the cause of happiness. Through this dharma, one is freed from rebirth as a hell being, hungry ghost, or animal. As a human or celestial being, one obtains all happiness, glory, and sovereignty. Yeah, so by living an ethical life, we're not reborn as a hell being, a hungry ghost, or an animal. And through virtue, we'll have happiness, glory, some kind of sovereignty over our lives as a human being or a celestial being. And through concentration, the four immeasurables of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, and the immaterial absorptions. In other words, these are high-level concentrations in the formless realm. One experiences the pleasure of Brahma and so forth. Such, in summary, is the dharma for higher rebirth and its results. So through the concentrations, these are form. The form realm is where beings have deep states of concentration. Formless realm is where their states of concentration are so deep that they don't really have a gross body and they're always in meditation. So this last verse 24, he's saying, through developing, you know, these intense states of samadhi on either the concentrations, the four immeasurables, the formless absorptions, then you experience rebirth in those realms, which is said to be very blissful. And so such, in summary, is the dharma for high rebirth and its results. So that last verse is talking about the rebirths in the form and formless realms. The previous verses that we talked about was helping us to have a precious human life, because a precious human life is much more advantageous than rebirth in the form and formless realms for attaining awakening. Okay, so that finishes the first part where he's talking about the highest, the higher rebirth, okay? In the next section, he's going into the highest good. So we'll do that tomorrow. Okay, a little bit of time for questions, maybe answers. Yeah.
So when you have a situation where someone put you at a place that strongly threatened your security for a long time, what steps can you take to not rejoice when that person loses his security?
I didn't hear the last part. What do you do when that person...
What steps can you take so you will not rejoice when that person loses his security?
When they lose it. So it's somebody who's threatening you, and then when they lose their security, you want to rejoice.
No. What steps can you take so you do not? So I found myself rejoicing, and at the same time, I was like, you're not supposed to do it. You're not supposed to do it. And so I was looking
Right. So you're rejoicing, and then what?
It happened. It was interesting. It was happening at the same time. As I was rejoicing, I was like, you're not supposed to do this. But yeah. I couldn't.
Stop it.
Yeah. So yeah. What steps can I take so I can stop it?
So you need to get very, very familiar with the meditation on rejoicing and practice it, not just when you're in situations like this, but the seven limb prayer. You know, we do that almost every day. Are you familiar with that prayer? Okay, is that in here? It should be. It should be the meditation on the Buddha. Okay. Bottom of page 8. Okay? So that's the short version of the seven-limb prayer. The fourth line in it is, and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. Okay? There's also other versions of the seven-limb prayer that are longer. But this prayer is very good to do, and then you stop on a daily basis and you practice rejoicing at other people's talents, their good opportunities, their virtue. So you are retraining your mind on a regular basis to rejoice at other people's good qualities so that you don't have jealousy towards them and then want to rejoice when they get what's coming to them. You know, you learn to abandon that kind of resentful attitude and just stay with, I rejoice. And here's somebody who's suffering. What do I train my mind in feeling when I see somebody suffer? Compassion. You know? Yeah. Letting go of the hurt that they caused you is a way to make yourself happy. Forgiving is what you do for yourself. Forgiving benefits you. Letting go of the anger and resentment you have towards somebody else. Who benefits when you do that? You do. Who suffers when we're angry and resentful? Who's suffering? Is the other person suffering from our anger and resentment? No, they're at the beach. Yeah, at the disco. They're living their life. Our anger doesn't make them miserable. Our anger makes us miserable. So, forgiving is a way to alleviate our own pain. Okay? Really think about this. Yeah? Wishing ill on somebody else does not harm them. But when our mind wants vengeance and is holding a grudge, who's suffering? Every single day when we generate hatred towards that person, who's suffering? Me. They're living their life. Yeah? So I need to let go of my anger so that I can be happy. Yeah? So then you think, you know, that person, they fell on bad times. Why should I rejoice? It's just a suffering human being. Yeah? And they hurt me in the past. But, you know, it's amazing when you really study how the mind works. They did something harmful to us. How many times did they do it? In some cases of harm, they harmed us one time. In some cases, it may have been repeated. But every day, when we think of what they did to us, they're no longer harming us. But when we think about it and we get angry and resentful, we're harming ourselves. They're no longer harming us. Yeah, this is amazing. When you study the mind, the harm is over. The harm is not happening now. Yet we are stuck in anger and resentment about something that is not happening now. The past is over. It's done. It's not happening. Why do we solidify the past, and hold on to it? It's of no benefit. Yeah? It's like over. So here is one aspect. You know, we human beings have a human intelligence, which His Holiness says is so precious, because our human intelligence allows us to learn the path and contemplate and meditate. But there's one way where I think animals have it over us. If you hurt an animal, it doesn't remember your harm every time it sees you. Some animals may be a little skittish every time they see you, but by and large, they get over it and they forget it. Yeah. I know when I get back, one of my cats, you know, she always gives me the cold treatment for one day. And then it's forgotten. Okay. Manjushri, the cat I told you about, the second one who died, he had some tumor on his leg, his back right paw. They had to amputate his whole back right paw. Yeah? He got up after the surgery. It hurt a little bit. He hobbled around, and it was like, okay, what else is new? I don't have a paw. I'm living with it. I'm learning to hobble. He went upstairs. He went downstairs. He was fine. Yeah? I looked at this cat, and I thought, he is not traumatized. A human being would go, oh my God, my leg was amputated. My life is ruined. I can't do anything. This is going to happen. That's going to happen. The other thing has happened. Nobody's going to love me. My life is over and I can't do anything. And on. The cat just said, okay, three paws, not four. Let's get on with it. Okay? Not stuck in the past. So this is one way where we human beings, we really torture ourselves. Yeah? When we hold on to that grudge, we want them to have a taste of their own medicine. Yeah? It ruins us. It's painful, isn't it? Isn't it? I mean, we don't want to live our whole lives that way. So dropping the anger is something that we do for ourselves. Dropping the anger and forgiving somebody does not mean what they did is okay. Yeah? The Holocaust was not okay. Child abuse is not okay. Racial discrimination is not okay. But we can forgive people who do it. Okay, so this is why they call it mind training, why they call it practice. We have to do it over and over again. We have to really retrain our mind away from our harmful attitudes. Not easy, but very beneficial. Okay. One thing that I found that was helpful for me to do, to let go of anger. Because I really wanted some of these people to apologize to me. You know, I mean, is it too much to ask that after they harm me so much, that they just come to their senses and say, I'm sorry? I mean, is that too much to ask? Why can't they just say, I'm sorry? If they say, I'm sorry, I'll forgive them in a heartbeat like that. I don't need more. Two words, I'm sorry. Yeah. Why can't they do that? And then I imagine the situation of them saying, I'm sorry. There he is, that macho Italian monk who tore me to shreds when I lived there, crawling up the aisle on his hands and knees, stopping every once in a while, culpa mia, culpa mia. And then resuming crawling from the back of the room up to the front of the room, lying on the ground here saying, please, children, forgive me for everything I did for you, to you. I am so sorry. I harmed you beyond belief. It was terrible. Please grace me with your forgiveness. And then I would look at him. I'll think about it. And then he'll plea again, you know, expressing his regret and how tormented he is for what he did. And finally, out of my gracious benevolence, I'll say, I'm glad you came to your senses. You beep, 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 beep. After what you did to me, I'm glad you came to your senses. You know? And I, you know, I find that for myself, exaggerating a scene is very helpful for me. You know? Because in my mind, somewhere in the back, I would really like that. You know? Not just a casual, you know what I did to you? I'm sorry. Not that. I want to feel apology. Okay? So I find that imagining that is really helpful for me to just go, yeah, what am I really wanting? What am I hanging on to here? My mind is ridiculous. And it's very helpful for just dropping the whole thing. Hmm? So it was quite amazing. I haven't told you my Italy stories, but you know how much I suffered. So last spring, I was invited back to the same Dharma center where all this happened. 21 months I spent at that Dharma center, like 21 beads on your mala. And towards the end, I wrote to Lama and I said, Lama, can I leave? These people are making me create negative karma. It's all their fault. And Lama wrote to me and said, we'll discuss it, dear. I'll be there in 6 months. So anyway, I went. They invited me to come back and teach. So none of the people that were so rude and awful and terrible to me, because you know I was sweet and innocent and kind, and they just horribly abused me. You know, I'm so nice. Why would they do that? Yeah. So none of them were there. Yeah, they've all gone on to do who knows what. But one man who was there, who saw this whole thing going on, yeah? After one puja, we were coming out the door from a puja, and he looked at me and he said, I'm really sorry for what happened to you here. And this was like 20 years ago. It was like, yeah, it was 79, you know, almost 30 years ago. Almost 30 years ago. And he said, I'm sorry for what happened to you here. And he wasn't even one of the persons that had harmed me. And I was like, wow. I mean, I just had to go away and take a long walk because I never, ever expected an apology from all of that. I knew that the people who do it, there was not going to be any apology. And also because Rinpoche had said something to me that threw out my ideas of apology, which I'll tell you in a moment. But it was just shocking to me that somebody apologized. I just was like flabbergasted. So what helped me along this thing is 30 years ago, after Lama came and after I left there, I had made my way back to Copan. And I was having tea with Rinpoche, you know, sitting on, they've subsequently torn down this building, but you could sit on the roof and overlook the Kathmandu Valley. And Rinpoche says to me, who is kinder to you, the Buddha, or we'll call this person Sam? Sam. Rinpoche, what kind of question is that? You know, and I said, the Buddha's kinder to me. Because Sam made me create all this negative karma getting angry at him. Sweet, innocent me. And Rinpoche looked at me with this look like, you know, kid, you still haven't gotten it, have you? And then he proceeded to explain to me why Sam was kinder to me than all of the Buddhas. Because in order to become a Buddha myself, I have to develop the perfection of fortitude, of inner strength. You can only develop that, the perfection of fortitude, and develop your inner strength when you have people that harm you. You can't develop heart fortitude towards people who are kind to you. So Rinpoche looked at me and he said, you need Sam. Sam is helping you to become a Buddha. You know, of course, that is not what I wanted to hear. I wanted some sympathy. I wanted Rinpoche to say, yes, I know Sam, oy vey. He really drives me crazy too. Very difficult person. You survived 21 months with him, congratulations. I wanted some sympathy. My teacher didn't give me any sympathy. He said, Sam is kinder to you than all the Buddhas. You need Sam. Otherwise, you can't become awakened. Okay? So that was something that spurred me to give up my melodramatic scene of Sam's apology. Yeah? So, okay. So our time's up. Let's dedicate.